I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. In October of 1985, a woman named Cherie Warren left work at a busy Salt Lake City office
to meet her estranged husband at a downtown auto dealership.
She never made it home. Cherie's car surfaced weeks later in Las Vegas.
In the parking lot of a hotel casino.
No one knows how it got there.
Strange. It was strange.
Both Cherie's estranged husband and her boyfriend raised suspicion for investigators.
I kind of thought that he might have done something.
But no arrests were ever made. In Cold Season 3, we dig into double lives, make new connections in the case, and examine the difficulty raised by reasonable doubt.
We want answers just as much as anyone else.
They have creeps like that now too, so nothing's changed.
That's the new Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie. Now available anywhere you get your podcasts.
Welcome to another episode of Relentlessly Resilient, where real people share real life experiences and the tools they've developed to move forward and live their best life. I'm Michelle Scharf.
And I'm Jenny Taylor. And Michelle, today we have Jenny Howe back with us. She's been a guest before, and we're so grateful she's joined us again. How are you, Jenny?
I'm so good. I feel so honored. I kept telling your producer, I feel so honored to be back again. So thanks for having me.
Oh, I think we could have you back on a monthly basis and never tire of it. For those of you who maybe didn't hear the first episode, we'll link it in the show notes. But Jenny Howe is a mental health provider, a professional with psychology background and licensed clinical. And Jenny, maybe you introduce yourself so I don't completely slaughter your professional credentials.
And I'll take all the credentials you give me.
Perfect.
But
a few letters at the end of your name.
I'll take them all. I have 2 degrees in psychology, but I'm a licensed clinical mental health counselor with a lot of experience as an elementary school counselor, actually, before I went into private practice. So a few different licenses, but overall now most of the scope of my practice is mental health counseling.
Okay, so it's May. It's Mental Health Awareness Month. It's also the end of the school year, as you mentioned. I don't think that I knew or remembered that you had that background in the school setting.
Yeah.
Can you talk for a minute about that, the school setting of school counseling and kids? I know as the school year ends, we're all just really counting down the days until it's summer. And yet school provides some structure and routine and predictability to our kids. So maybe just give us a little bit of your background as we're talking about mental health awareness of all ages. Maybe what did you see or what are some things you might share with our audience about those school years you had with some of the young people in our community?
Yeah, I mean, May is such a crazy month for families in general, right? We like try to cram as much as we can into May, all their end of the year things and all of the award ceremonies and all of these really like wonderful celebrations are all in May, which is a really cool thing. But it kind of feels, I think, for a lot of kids, like a lot of pressure, especially if they aren't the ones receiving those awards. So I spent about 10 years working as an elementary school counselor. And in that time, now we've evolved to do end of level testing as well. And so we throw that on these little kids and our poor teachers as well to do in May, in a month that's already filled with a lot of pressure and a lot of recognition and a lot of just like singular recognition, right? So it is a month of just chaos, not just for us as parents and mothers, but for our kids. And even in the tiny little bodies, they feel the pressure of these end of level tests. If I had a dime for every little kid that's come into my office over the years, the last 25 years, I'm old, but has told me like they feel like they're going to fail a grade or they'll be held back if they don't pass their end of level tests, I would be rich.
Oh.
So it's a lot of pressure.
That is. So what advice would you have for maybe parents or teachers listening? I mean, obviously at this point, we're at the very, very end of the year, but that end of the year comes back every year. How
exactly.
do we help? Obviously, there's value to testing. There's maybe a purpose to celebrate accomplishments, not necessarily say get rid of all of that because it's causing anxiety. How do we maybe help in either how we present it, our expectations onto those children, or how do we help them as they receive or perceive those expectations?
Well, the best thing we can do as parents always across the board is model, right? I had a session yesterday with a parent and she asked me this question because I see her children. She asked me like what she was doing wrong as a parent. And the advice I gave her is advice I give myself daily because I'm also a parent and I suck at it half the time, just like everybody else, right? But like the advice I gave to her was what you show your kids and what you model your kids in terms of pressure and anxiety and the way that you label your emotions is really what they're going to absorb and then take into their life. So it's much less about like how we prepare or predict or like, you know, create a safe space for kids to like proactively like go into testing. It's much more about like the conversations we're having in the safe space we're having as they're having emotional reactions. So an example of that would be like, let's say you notice your kid comes home from school, you have a child in third grade and your third grader comes home and is really defiant, really kind of like a stinker, and you're doing your best to hold it together in May. The best thing we can do in that moment is say, gosh, you know what? When I'm irritable, sometimes I take that out on other people, and I was super irritable yesterday and you might've heard me like yell at you to clean your room. And afterwards, I was like, gosh, I'm actually really stressed about this particular thing happening in my life. And that's why I think I yelled at you to clean your room. And I'm wondering if maybe there's a feeling happening right now that I'm not seeing. I know May is really stressful. Is there something going on at school? And so giving them the language and the tools via like our own experiences and modeling for them like rupture and repair, that's what really helps our kids handle stress and chaos. Sometimes I think we have to have it all together and we don't. What we need to do is just talk about not having it all together, together with our kids, and then creating that space where they can too talk about their things.
I know when I was a young mom, it would have been helpful for me to understand self-regulation a little bit more and triggers. Because when your kid walks through that door, even if you've been having a peaceful day at home and you're like, oh, it's been so nice and it's such a crazy month.
Yeah.
And it's so peaceful right now. And then they walk through the door and they come in with all that baggage and that energy and those emotions. Then sometimes it's easy to forget where they are coming from because we've been in a peaceful place. And then we have problems self-regulating that. And so I know looking back, my kids are all raised now. I just wish that I would have had the conscious awareness to be understanding my own feelings and say, oh, I'm being triggered about this emotion because I'm sensing that and feeling that from my kids or experiencing the fallout from their behavior. I'm going to take a step back here before I sit down and talk with my child. But, you know, it's funny because there was a situation with my grandson recently and he kind of was having an explosion where I actually said, hey, let's talk about this. What's going on here? How are you feeling? Where are you feeling that in your body? And then we talked about what was going on and where that was all coming from. And then he, you know, hugged me and he hugged his mom and my son kind of teared up and he said, where is that mother that raised when
I didn't get that.
I would have liked that mother to raise me. Where is this coming from? And I'm like, you know, unfortunately,
sorry, guinea pig.
I'm like, unfortunately, we learn a lot. And just about the time we learn it, we're done.
Isn't that the truth?
So, yeah. So there is that moment. I think that that's just a good thing to kind of talk about for moms who may be hearing this episode. Like, it's okay that you get caught up in it, but what's happening is you're actually connecting with that feeling and it's easy to be drawn into it. And self-management is about learning how to separate that and then react not from that triggered emotion or response, but from a space of love and communication.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I completely agree with you. If I keep using this reference, like if I had a dime for every time a kid was referred to me in therapy and the real work was working with the parents to help them model the self-regulation, right? I would be a billionaire because it's really the work of us as parents and adults in children's lives, right? Providing that sense of stability, again, not by the absence of emotional reaction. We want to have emotional reactions, right? We don't want them to suppress anything. That's like way bad. But what we want to gift them is the opportunity of emotional labeling and walking through that with them. And just like you said, with your
the resolution to feelings, right?
Exactly.
Like I understand you're here. Talk about that. Where are you feeling in that, in your body? What does that feel like to you? Where is this coming from? Oh, tell me about that experience and then be able to get to whatever it is and then talk and resolve. It might be, well, so-and-so called me a terrible name or so-and-so called my mother a terrible name at school and it really made me angry and I didn't feel good about it. I can understand that having empathy and understanding for, oh, I didn't like it when people made fun of my mom when I was your age either. That doesn't feel good, does it? I want you to know that it doesn't hurt me. And those things that your people may say about me, those things, they're not kind, but they're not going to hurt me. And I want you to know that I still love you, and you don't have to be angry or carry those things with you, you know, mm-hmm. whatever it is, to help them get from point A to point B.
Right. That's where the modeling comes in, right? That's why that's so imperative, because as parents, I think, and especially as women, I think we have to like portray ourselves. We feel a pressure to portray ourselves as like being calm and collected and like, you know, stress-free, when that's just not realistic. And I think that that's poor messaging we give to our daughters, especially, right? So it's the modeling of walking through what that emotion feels like and the labeling of that emotion and how it feels in your body. And then asking the child where they feel that feeling and how that feels in their body, like you're suggesting, mm-hmm. like it's the modeling of the process of emotional regulation that we really gift our children. It's not the suppression or I'm going to stay calm in the middle of this divorce that I'm going through, or whatever it is, right?
Right.
Like, we want to teach our children that emotions, especially the negative ones, especially anxiety, are really fruitful emotions. They're gifts to us, right? Yeah. Emotions like guilt, which a lot of people really hate, is such a gift to teach us about our values. Anxiety is such a gift to teach us about what is meaningful to us and what risks are worth taking. Like, all of these demonized emotions that we are afraid of sharing with people often, we really can model for our kids as being useful tools that navigate us to paths of values.
Right.
And so I think, you know, you're exactly right. The modeling of that includes both like our experience and then also walking through that with our children or grandchildren in your case, right? And teaching them what that looks like for them.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I just started a coaching program and I've been coaching some people. And what's interesting is that part of this is teaching those adults how to self-regulate and what those emotions are actually teaching them. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
So it's like sometimes the loop they get stuck in isn't actually the problem itself. It's just not understanding. Like, oh, like there's kind of conceptual beliefs that like we shouldn't feel angry. We shouldn't feel anxiety. And I love how you just reframed that and said, these emotions are normal. They're healthy. Mm-hmm. It's what we do and what we create or surrounding them that makes the difference. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Like a huge red flag for me as a therapist is if a parent comes in and says that they've never had any issues with their kid. I'm like, really?
Like, have you been living in the same house?
Yeah. Like, my kids give me all kinds of issues. I have two very different children. But like, you know, it's to me, the lack of negative emotional expression inside a home is a huge key to there being a lack of safety, a lack of emotional safety inside the home. Because when we feel safe enough to rummage around in the dirtiness of our feelings, that's intimacy. That's a real relationship. So having good kids or perfect kids to me is a marker of some sort of like pathology, interestingly enough.
Let's maybe wrap this one up for just a quick second. Jenny, I love what you're saying about giving space, and Michelle too, for those negative emotions or the emotions that we as a society try to avoid or pretend don't exist. So tell me this concept of having a safe space where you can have, what'd you say, the dirty emotions or the dirtiness of those feelings. So I get the modeling is so important. What do I model in that moment of that child throwing that fit or that tantrum? Or maybe I'm the mom and I'm the one that's throwing the fit or the tantrum. Is the modeling better to come back after the fact and say, hey, like you said, I realized I was really frustrated. I took it out on you. Or what's that conversation look like? What does the modeling look like? I love the concept of that safe space. What does it look like with whether it's me or the child that's having that difficulty with those emotions that you've called fruitful that I probably would have said, ooh, we want to avoid those. So that's a good paradigm shift.
Yeah. I think anytime a child or an adult is throwing a tantrum of any kind, right? What that is showing me as a human being or as a parent is that they're struggling to find the words to some sort of feeling that they're having inside their body, right? That's not generally a go-to behavior. People really want to avoid throwing tantrums. So if they're at that stage, even little children do, right? If they're at that stage of throwing a tantrum, that means that they're tapped out. They don't have the words to match whatever they're feeling. So the best way to respond to that situation, and we're going to be frustrated as heck as parents, right, in that moment. But the best way to handle that is to see the tantrum and label it. So how I would handle that is saying something along the lines of, I can see you're really frustrated right now. I'm going to give you a minute to be frustrated, and then I'm going to come back in the room and we can talk about it if you're ready. And I'm ready. So it's labeling that emotion for them in the moment and then walking away, collecting yourself, doing the regulation that you were talking about earlier, and then re-entering the conversation. The thing that I really like, the little phrase that I use often that you've probably heard cliched over the years as well, is rupture and repair, right? We want the experience to be a tantrum. That's okay. It's okay. It's safe to have a tantrum in this house. Like, you don't need to pull yourself together quickly. You can have that frustration. But we are going to come back and repair this. We're going to reconcile. We're going to have a conversation about this. And intimacy is created in that cycle. We have to have rupture or tantrums in this case, and we have to have repair. That's where we create intimacy in any of our relationships. So if we're missing rupture, there's a lack of intimacy. If we're missing repair, there's a lack of intimacy. So when we model as parents self-regulation and coming in and out and then repairing whatever rupture there was, whether that's a child tantruming on the floor or us yelling at our kids to clean their rooms, right? Whatever it is, when we come back and circle back to that conversation, that's where the depth of the relationship is really restored. So I think I had, I can't remember if I shared this with you on the last podcast, but it's worthy of an example, I think, again, here really quick. I had a moment, many moments, but when I was raising my daughter as a single mom and she was in high school, she's now almost 21. So she's older now, but, and working for a federal senator, I might say, if I can brag about her
for
a moment.
Throw that in there. Good job.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Yeah. But she was, I don't even remember what the issue was. She had done, there was some sort of argument that took place. And she was in her room on FaceTime with one of her girlfriends on the phone. And I walked in and like said something to her. And then I noticed real quickly she was on FaceTime. And then I walked out because she had like mouthed off to me again. And I just immediately turned around and walked right back out. And I was standing outside her door and the door was shut. And I heard her say to her friend, like, her friend must have asked, like, what did your mom want? And she's like, I don't know. She just walks out sometimes when I talk to her. And I was like, yes, you're right. I do, because I'm self-regulating. And so I knew then that I needed to come back and tell her at some point, whenever we repaired that, like, hey, when I walk out, I'm not being dismissive. I'm trying to like keep myself collected because I am heightened and I want to come back and have a conversation with you that's like helpful, not like anger filled. And so something like that, I think, is a good example of what we've been talking about, right? Like, there's regulation involved. There's sometimes we need to take a step back, and that's great. Teaching our kids that they can take a step back is like huge for them, right? Like, you don't have to pretend. You can take a step back and then come back and have the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. I love this. When we come back, we're going to talk about anxiety, and I can't wait to hear about the things I probably should have done. I did not do. We'll be right back.
Two years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was three blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby?
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com. Follow us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you listen.
And we're back. Jenny, I'm hearing this, and then I am thinking about a child with severe anxiety disorder. Mm-hmm. I have a child when she was very young. It actually started in infancy. She would have these fits, And as she got older, you know, I would swaddle her. I would offer her food. I would offer her comfort. I never was able to identify what the culprit was, like, because this started very young. And by the time she was eight, she was having a lot of issues. But by that point, well, let me back up. When she was two, she was throwing a fit in a Target. And a lady came up to me and said, "Do I need to call security?" And I'm like, "Well, if you think it would be helpful, like, I'm willing to take any help, you know?" And she said, "Somebody's got to save that baby from you." And I literally, she's clawing at my face. I've got scratches. I'm bleeding. I'm sweating because I am embarrassed. I've got to get my son his choir outfit for the end of school stuff. And and so I'm stressed out and I don't know what to do. And I finally just decide to leave. I'm not done with everything I need, but I need to get her out of there. And I don't want to have a scene where, you know, somebody's accusing me of something because I put her down on the ground. She hit her head on the cement. I picked her up. Then she started grabbing the racks of clothes and pulling them over. This is a 2.5-year-old baby. You know, I mean, she was something. And when I got to the checkout stand, there was an older couple there and they were just kind of looking and smiling at me. And they said, "Oh, it's okay. You know, we understand. Like, we've been there." And then she started freaking out again while the checker was checking out. And I put her down and she was wearing like a little dress. And she went over and she took off her diaper and she just chucked it at the cashier. And
she has gumption.
I'm telling you, this child was something. Anyways, this has gone on for, you know, and I'd taken her to doctors and I'd taken her to therapists. And by the time she was eight, we went to a psychiatrist. I still never had help with me regulating me in those scenarios because I didn't know how to handle it. And they were so extreme. The events were extreme. My friends named them. My friends named the episodes the Super Freaks. And and so, like, this was not a small thing, right? And I'm just wondering, you know, hopefully today the psychiatrist or the therapist would be better and they would be working with the parent on deregulation. But this was a lot driven from anxiety disorder manifesting in a child. And so what are your recommendations for if somebody hears this episode and they're like, "Oh, my gosh, that is my child." And it is exhausting. It takes every ounce of patience to not hurt that child because they push you. They physically push you. Sure. They emotionally push you. What are your recommendations and what kind of therapist are you looking for to seek treatment or diagnosis in a child having episodes like that?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to really define an anxiety disorder versus anxiety, right? Because anxiety is something that's really normal. And like I said earlier, fruitful. It's something we all experience, right? We all are born with this threat reflex system in our brain that's functioned by the amygdala and our limbic system. And that protects us. It keeps us safe. You know, in today's world, there's a lot of false alarms. There's a lot of misperceived threats. And that can sometimes create anxiety where we don't want it. And that's when we can like utilize a therapist or something like that. But an anxiety disorder is something that is, there are three ways I measure it: frequency, duration, and intensity. Right. So if your child or you are having anxious episodes or irritated episodes, things that feel like a nervous system response in your body, which I'll talk about in just a second, and they are getting more intense, they are lasting longer, they're not decreasing, you're not seeing that recovery at all, right? The duration is increasing, and then you're seeing them increase in frequency. Right. And this manifests like often in little kids at school, for example, like preschool separation anxiety or elementary school separation anxiety, when it's normal for kids to kind of like you need to peel them off their mom the first day or two when they go in. But if that escalates in intensity, duration, and in frequency for like a period of time, then you probably know it's time to see a therapist about getting some help and support for your child. My recommendation across the board for children, especially, and I've spent the majority of my career specializing in children and teens, is to always seek therapeutic guidance before we seek medicinal guidance, not because medicines aren't helpful, but anxiety specifically is a nervous system based disorder, right? It's a deregulation of our nervous system. And people with an anxiety disorder have a baseline that is above the norm. So if I'm trying to like imagine what it might feel like to have an anxiety disorder, it's kind of like how you or I may feel like right as we're climbing to the top of a roller coaster and we get that kind of like response, protective response in our body. And it feels like something bad is going to happen. You have this cognitive understanding that it's going to be fun. Like I chose this, I want to be on this, but your body is telling you something different. That's kind of what it's like, I would imagine, living with an anxiety disorder. And so when we have a disorder, we just have to seek extra support for that. I don't think any parent, including myself as a therapist, would be equipped to handle a true anxiety disorder or any kind of mental health disorder alone mm-hmm. with my child. We need to access like our village, our support system, and get tools for that. Because it is a nervous system-based disorder, and what I mean by the nervous system is our brain and our spinal cord, right, are attached to all these different nerves that literally run the ship. They're like the computer of our body. And when we are born with a nervous system that's sensitive or hotwired, that's the word I often use in therapy, like a little hotwired, then it feels like it's always on. Right? There's not an off button there. And so therapy really is teaching people how to, and we can do this. And there's a lot of evidence and a lot of science to really back this up, but it's teaching people how to train their nervous system response to be a little less hotwired. And we want to teach that to people via this idea of like exposing them to things that are really triggering and then allowing them to recover. And each time we recover from a nervous system response or an anxiety episode or a panic attack or something like that, our brain then is like, that thing wasn't as threatening because we didn't actually die. And it banks all of those responses and creates this kind of generalized response across the board to our nervous system. So that's like the real science of regulation mm-hmm. and emotional regulation is we really are training our body to respond differently. And that can happen. And good therapeutic work for anxiety focuses on that.
Where do you look for when it's in a child?
What do I look for in terms of anxiety?
Well, like where would a parent look for those therapy? Because like I went to our medical doctor, our medical doctor sent us to a therapist. The therapist sent us to the child psychiatrist. The child psychiatrist ended up just giving us medications. So I never felt like we really managed this in a healthy way. And during her childhood, she's gone to therapy now, but I'm just thinking, I know that my kid isn't the only kid out there with this issue. And so if somebody's hearing this today and here it is at the end of the school year, it's at a heightened time. There's a, I know that for my child, that was a horrible, I hated May. Yeah. May was like the worst month of life. And of course it makes it worse for moms, but that stress carries over to the kids and it's a terrible cycle. Right. And so I'm just, if they're out hearing it, like what is, who are they seeking treatment for? Do they have to start with their medical doctor? That may be based on insurance, but what kind of a therapist is going to be able to understand this process and be able to both work with the parent and the child to create better outcomes?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of different things I'm hearing. I think on one hand, right, when we are dealing with just an anxiety disorder, I don't mean just in like a patronizing way, but if we're dealing with like generalized anxiety disorder, which is one of the most common, or separation anxiety disorder, right, those two are often found in children, or OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, we would definitely want to seek a therapist that has experience treating. Every therapist is going to say they treat anxiety, by the way.
I know.
But that's, you want to look for.
That's why I'm asking you this question, because I've heard it like, oh, well, I am a child therapist.
I specialize in it.
But I never felt like we got anywhere.
Yeah, you're going to look for the gold standard now, and I can say this like with certainty now, is two different responses, cognitive behavioral therapist, but a branch out of that is exposure response prevention therapist. So that's called exposure therapy. And that is the real like evidence, scientifically based research, all that stuff that we want, right? Model for treating kids with anxiety, adults with anxiety as well, but we're talking about kids, for treating people with anxiety. And there aren't a lot, of therapists that specialize in exposure response prevention therapy. A lot of therapists who are trained and certified to treat obsessive compulsive disorder, they all have exposure response prevention training. You have to, it's a part of the criteria, but in order to, like, if I was looking for a therapist for my child with anxiety, I would want to know what their training was specifically, because I'm going to say something here, maybe a little controversial, but I'm going to say it anyway, because I believe it. And I think it's kind of a soapbox of mine being an actual anxiety specialist, is we don't treat anxiety by teaching people coping skills. Because it's just like, you and I could do a Google search right now of like how to take deep breaths and right. tell ourselves that we're just going to deep breathe our way through life. Yes. And great, hooray, like that's great. But when you have somebody with an anxiety disorder, they need a model that's more sophisticated than that. And they need to actually learn how to train their nervous system to respond differently, or else it's just not going to work. I can't tell you how many people sit on my couch and say, like, if I have one more therapist try to teach me how to breathe my way through this panic attack, I'm going to literally lose my mind, because it's so invalidating to yes. the actual experience they're having, right? And so to say, like, you're right, that's never going to work. It's never going to work for you to deep breathe your way through a panic attack. And we see that through like TikToks and social media and popular culture on TV shows and like all of these things, right? But what we really have to do is teach people to navigate what that fear is, teach people how to deregulate their nervous system response, and teach people that fear isn't something to be afraid of, that we can tolerate it. And we only learn how to tolerate something by experiencing it. That's the only way that our body acclimates. There's this process of habituation, fancy psychological term. It just means getting used to something. But the process of habituation is crucial in the treatment of anxiety. And the best example I can give is like when you go into the ocean, like the Pacific Ocean, especially, and it's so freezing, it's always mm-hmm. freezing. I'm from San Diego, so I can say
yeah.
that.
Yeah, it's freezing, true.
Mm-hmm. Right? You go into the Pacific Ocean, you're like, oh my gosh, it's so cold. And we all like tiptoe and we have this like visceral physical response mm-hmm. to feeling the cold of the Pacific Ocean. But then like 2 minutes later, your sister or your girlfriend comes running up and they're like, hey, how's the water? And you're like, oh, it's so fine. It's fine. Like it's warm. Come on in. Because your body, your nervous system goes through this process of shock and then recovery automatically. We don't even have mm-hmm. to think about it. And it acclimates or habituates to the environment it's in. That's exactly what happens with fear and anxiety if we teach our body to do that. And mm-hmm. so the work for anxiety treatment, the work especially for treating OCD, is to teach our body that we can have this heightened kind of anxious experience and then recover over and over and over again. And so we don't avoid worst case scenarios. We actually embrace them. And the work is very counterintuitive to what our body is telling us would be real. But if we have an anxiety disorder, our body's lying to us already anyway, all the time. So we have to do things that negate that lie that our body is telling us.
It's so interesting. So, and I, you know, here yeah. I was a massage therapist and I practiced meditation. And so yeah. I was practicing breathing with my child all the time. And I was thinking, why doesn't this work with her? And, but I mean, literally I was getting no help. I mean, I was just getting offered medications and tests and
yeah.
being stared at while I felt like they just think I'm a hysterical mom. They don't understand yeah. the degree that this child is out of control. Yeah. And I was really concerned and worried about her. I mean, like yeah. And we've talked a little bit about it now that she's older, but it's like, you know, if you're dealing with a child like this, it is one of the hardest, I think, as a mother, because there's so much mystery into it, because you see the reaction, but there's no logical reason it's even happening.
Like, sure.
It yeah, could happen course. Because she could be sitting in a quiet room playing and all of a sudden it could just be throwing toys and screaming mm-hmm. and hitting and breaking things, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's like, what? Mm-hmm. And it makes you think there's something really wrong with my child, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, and to some degree there is, right?
Right.
There is a real physical thing that's happening inside your child that is creating that response. And yeah. that's you know, the thing we need to address. And you hit the nail on the head in terms of often we as my therapist cohorts, right, mm-hmm. look for the reasons why, and that's not always valuable. Sometimes right. it is, depending on what we're treating. But in the case of anxiety, what I really want to do is just focus on training that nervous system to respond differently. Yeah. It doesn't, there's this funny thing. When I was trained to and certified to treat OCD, one of the clinicians wrote on the board that was training us, like, we don't care about feelings, ha ha ha. And it was like this joke the whole time, because really when we're treating anxiety, we don't care why you feel the way you feel. We can see you feel that way. We just want to help you feel differently. And yeah. we do that with action and exposure. So you hit the nail on the head. Trying to figure it out is futile.
Right.
But what we can do is offer a solid treatment approach that's going to focus on action and, you know, the reversal, really, in a lot of cases, especially with children, of that nervous system response that they were born with.
I love hearing that. And it makes me happy to know that there's answers, because I know that my kid's not the only one that's ever dealt with this. And, sure. you know, my kids are just having kids, and it gives me hope and excitement to think that there mm-hmm. is actual things that could be done that don't even require medication. It's
well,
really
and that actually help, because sometimes that actually even help. The medication yeah. alone doesn't
it
help.
Doesn't help.
Yeah.
It, but in our case, exactly. it didn't help. We need to yeah. take a break. When we come back, we want to hit on OCD. So we're back. Before we move on to OCD, I do want to clarify that it's not just children that have this. Sometimes adults still have this dysregulation. They have not been able to find the support, care, help that they need in order to resolve this stuff. Yeah. So even an adult listening might identify with them yeah. with this podcast, with hearing this message. And so it's really great. And so the key kind of therapy that if somebody's dealing with this, cognitive behavioral therapist and exposure response therapist, right?
Yes, exactly. You nailed it.
And I would love to learn a little bit more, as it's Mental Health Awareness Month. We hear terms like anxiety, OCD, depression, mental illness. I mean, they're almost buzzwords anymore. I'm yeah. glad that Michelle said, let's learn about OCD. Break it down, anxiety disorder, OCD. What are the distinguishing features? Where do you go from being just kind of particular and you like things a certain way? And, or like you mentioned, you have anxiety and that's just a normal part of life. Where do you mm-hmm. cross that line, or what do you look for either in yourself or someone around you to where, hey, either this OCD or anxiety is now that D, that disorder. I would love to better understand OCD clinically, especially in yeah. relation to anxiety, because anxiety is everywhere, OCD is everywhere, depression's everywhere. Yeah. Help us put some awareness behind it so we can know what maybe is a little bit of the normal journey versus, hey, professional yeah. help is needed.
You're like, I'm feeling the excitement in my body because I feel so passionate about teaching people about anxiety and OCD. So like, as you're doing that, I have all these things to say. So I'm going to try to like be succinct here. OCD is technically not an anxiety disorder, believe it or not. It's in its own category in our diagnostic manual. The way I describe OCD versus anxiety is really like your body feels really uncomfortable and you're doing your best to try to like preventatively, you know, or retroactively kind of manage that feeling, right? With OCD, anxiety is actually not present. In fact, the majority of the clients that I work with and have worked with over the last 7 years that I've specialized in OCD don't have an anxiety disorder. They don't even have anxiety. So that's an important, and I think something that we really need to talk about.
I'm kind of surprised. I would think
everybody
makes you very anxious. You're very anxious that things aren't as in order as you want them to be.
Let me walk you through the steps of OCD. So we have an obsession and we have a compulsion. An obsession is a thought that gets stuck in our brain that we don't properly put in the trash bin. So essentially we have like upwards, I think now, of 40,000 thoughts a day. We obviously aren't conscious of all of those thoughts. Our brain does a very good job of navigating the thoughts that have meaning, putting them into our frontal lobe, allowing us to think about them, and trashing the other ones. That's why we dream at night, by the way. That's like our trash bin kind of rummaging through our thoughts at the end of the day. But with OCD specifically, there are times that a thought, a trash thought, for some reason gets stuck. And we call that an obsession or sometimes an intrusive thought. And so you'll hear people with OCD say, oh, I just can't get this thought out of my head. Like, it's stuck. And we all have like kind of remnants of understanding what that might feel like when we have like a song in our head, or we have like this particular situation with a friend that's just kind of stuck in our head. So we have an idea, but for people with OCD, the thought that's stuck in their head doesn't match their value system. We call it ego dystonic, which means it's not something that generally is meaningful to them. It's something that they're like, why the heck am I thinking about this all the time? This is so frustrating. I don't want to be thinking about arranging the pillows, for example, all the time. I really don't care if the pillows are not arranged properly. So that's the key diagnostic component of OCD, is it's something called ego dystonic, which means it just doesn't match our values. It's something that goes against what we actually want. So the anxiety is created as a result of that dissonance. So the anxiety that people with OCD feel, it's not like, oh, I have to have this perfect because I prefer it. It's, I feel a sense of urgency to fix this thing, because if I don't fix this thing, then something bad perceived may happen. So the urgency or the anxiety they feel is a result of the thought. It's not there all the time, as is the case with like an anxiety disorder, for example. So rather than focusing on the anxiety that somebody with OCD feels, I call it urgency. And it's an urgency to fix something. And then when they fix the thing, they straighten the pillows, using your example, they feel momentary relief. But what they've just done is they've trained their nervous system that they have to fix the pillow in order to feel relief. And so then that cycle is just reinforced and reinforced and reinforced and reinforced over and over and over again, which creates that emotional response, anxious response in this case, exponentially, right? Because anytime we do something and we reinforce it, then we create a bigger emotional response. We see that with how we train our puppies or our kids, right? For an example. So people with OCD are stuck in a cycle of intrusive thought that isn't a thought they necessarily want to have. Like, some of the dirtiest people I know are people with contamination-based OCD. I had a client once whose feet, he was a 16-year-old boy. I adore him to death. His feet were black. He loved to like mountain bike and play in the dirt. He constantly had these black feet. One time he even got an infection on his toe. They almost had to cut off his toe because he was so unclean. But like, he had to have things in his room a certain way in order to prevent this bad thing from happening. So we all talk about like, oh, I'm a little OCD. I have to put the dishes away before I go to bed at night. Or, you know, I have to like check my locks a couple of times. That's not OCD. That's a preference. I prefer to have my dishes gone. Like, you don't think the world's going to end if the dishes are in your sink. If you had to leave the dishes in your sink, you wouldn't have a panic attack. You wouldn't completely lose your cool. It would be uncomfortable, maybe. It's not your preference, right? But you wouldn't have this fear attached to it. People with OCD would do anything to not have to keep their house straight, just using that as one example.
Yeah.
And that's a very like minute.
I think we really overuse that.
We do.
And completely misunderstand it.
You explaining it to me in that way. I mean, people mm-hmm. have accused me of being OCD or whatever on certain little things. And I've never thought that I was. And honestly, after your explanation, I'm so far from that.
But it can be a preference. You prefer.
It's a preference.
You feel more at peace when things are a certain way or a certain routine.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, exactly. And you'll see in the OCD community, if you ever like Instagram, and I have a great resource for any listeners out there, iocdf.org, the International OCD Foundation.org, has the most up-to-date research. It's the company where I get my credentials, where I'm also trained to treat OCD, but it's also just world renowned in terms of its research. Anybody who has questions about this can go there and access some really easy to read pamphlets and some really hard to read research, depending on what they want to do there. But great resource. But I have this ritual, for example, every night when I go to bed, right? I like my sheets straight a certain way. I like to make sure like my pillowcase is tucked in. There are things there that make me feel more comfortable, but I don't fear that I won't be able to sleep the whole night if I don't do that thing the exact way. And I don't fear that anything bad is going to happen as a result of that, mm-hmm. right? There's this ominous threat of something bad happening if I don't do this thing this specific way that people with OCD live with. And the real crappy part about having OCD is the cognitive dissonance. And what I mean by that is when your brain is telling you one thing, but you're doing another thing, right? That's never comfortable for any of us. And cognitive dissonance is the cause of a lot of depression and anxiety in people. But for people with OCD, they have a brain that is fully functioning. In fact, people with OCD are some of the most intellectually gifted people that I work with. Their brain is just working all the time, right? But they have this brain that's like, look, dude, like you don't need to go check this lock again. There's no way, like, you're so stupid. Why are you doing that again? And they have this compulsion, this sense of urgency that if they don't, something bad's going to happen or their house is going to burn down or whatever that particular fear is for them. And so there's this huge gap between what they know to be reality and what their nervous system is telling them is real. And that causes so much distress for people. But the hope is the exposure response prevention therapy that I mentioned briefly when talking about anxiety is the absolute gold standard for treating OCD. And we treat it using some other forms of therapy too. It's not just a one trick pony, but it is remarkable what we have in science to show us the difference in even just like brain functioning from people with OCD engaging in this treatment. We can really do some strong work with the nervous system. So there's a lot of hope for OCD, but it's an incredibly painful condition to live with. To anybody out there who has any idea that maybe they might be or has questions that their child might be, I really could not recommend more seeking out an OCD specialist, because therapists are not trained specifically to treat OCD. Just like we wouldn't go to like a dermatologist to treat breast cancer, we wouldn't go to like a therapist who specializes in, you know, depression to treat OCD.
Anxiety, like, even though a lot of us might think, oh, these are in the same bubble.
Exactly. It's different. And we have to have that exposure response prevention therapy for sure in order to treat it accurately. Some of the most devastating cases that I work with are adults, which I don't often work with adults, but I'll take OCD cases that are adults who have been treated by people in my profession with really great intentions and great meaning to like with their OCD for years. And all that talk therapy has done is just reinforced the obsessions and compulsions mm-hmm. over the years. And it's really put them in a position to have to like unlearn years and years and years of that compulsive like reinforcement. And it's devastating to me. Like it makes me emotional when I have these clients come in and they could have, if they had just been given the right treatment, right? The right scope of treatment when they were younger, they would have lived a completely different life. So it's essential that we find the therapist that is specialized in that.
Okay. We don't have a ton of time left. I wish we had way mm-hmm. more, but let's talk about that. How do you find the right therapist? I mean, we might spend more time trying to find the right pair of shoes than we do.
Totally.
And especially in today's right now, like there's a mental health care shortage.
Right.
To say nothing of what your insurance might not provide cover, or if it's close enough that you can actually get to an in-person visit. But do you have any just quick tips or tricks if someone's looking for help for themselves, for a child, for a family member or loved one? How do you shop for a therapist? Because I know way too many people have said therapy's not for me because they didn't find the right treatment program therapist.
Totally agree. It's a lot like dating, right? You're going to have, like, you need to find a personality that's going to connect with you. But the biggest recommendation I can give is don't feel like you're limited to what your insurance will cover. Insurance companies and mental health coverage is so frustrating. So frustrating for me as a clinician, especially for children and adolescents, because in order to get coverage from an insurance company, you have to have a diagnosis. And it often takes a long time. If a therapist is doing their job properly and not just reporting for an insurance company, it takes them a long time to diagnose a child and adolescent, especially. So my best recommendation is in mental health, unfortunately, a lot of therapists who are self-pay are the ones that really specialize and know what they're doing and are going to be very thorough and take their time with your child. And that's not to say that people that are insurance credentialed, well, I have some credentials with some insurance companies, so I understand that, like, we access, you know, care through lots of different sources, but there's ways to pay for therapy that doesn't feel as constrictive as we might think. Even with self-pay, there's out-of-network benefits that are often really accessible, where at least half of it would be covered. And if it were my child, I would much rather pay half out of pocket or whatever it is that I need to do to get them the specialty care than run them through a crescendo of therapists who don't know how to treat my child specifically. So I think often we look for, okay, what's going to fit with my insurance company or what's going to fit with my lifestyle, rather than what's going to work to provide the right treatment. And for some reason, we think mental health care is like generalized. It's not. We would never go, like, we would see, if we have a serious mental medical condition, we would see the specialist that was the top specialist regardless.
Absolutely.
Like, people do this all the time, but we don't think of mental health care the same way. And it's so frustrating to me, because if you want a good therapist, A, you're probably going to have to pay for that, right? And B, you're probably going to have to go out of your way to access that. And I wish that weren't true. Like, I'd love to change the system. Trust me, I have a whole nonprofit, whole idea on how I'd like to. But until we can get to that point, you need to treat it as though you would be treating a life-threatening medical condition.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it is, in some cases, life-threatening. And some of them start out small. And if you can catch them in those early years, like if somebody could have helped me and my daughter when she was young and having those outbursts, could have, like, she still struggles with anxiety.
It would have changed the trajectory of both of your lives.
Both of our lives.
It would have.
Yeah,
and
sure.
Our relationship. And right. And for that, I still ache over that. And
yes.
And I actually did look. I just didn't, I no longer knew where to look, you know? Anyway, it's a challenging thing. So for anyone who's struggling out there with anxiety disorder, OCD, whether you're a child, a parent, whether
adult of any age,
an adult of any age, and you're just had enough and you want to live a more peaceful life, we really encourage you to seek out therapy and seek out the correct kind of therapy.
And don't feel trapped that because you made an appointment with a provider, you have to make the next appointment with the same provider.
Oh, yes.
It's like the second date.
You can say no to a second date.
You can go on the blind date with as many as you need to, and that might feel tiring and cumbersome and maybe even expensive, but it will be worth the investment of the time and kind of investigation a bit to find out.
Especially in the long run.
Yeah. Oh, Jenny, absolutely. We can't wait to have you back already. Thank you for joining us. And I know to any listeners in the KSL news radio audience, she's often on some of the other shows here as well. Just a very respected expert in her field. I think you could feel that in the few minutes we were able to share with her today, that she doesn't just check the box, but that she's really putting the effort into to finding ways to help the people that need the help they need, and not just one size fits all, which, of course, there is no one size fits all to any of this. So
we're
thanks,
so
Jenny,
complex.
For joining us. Yeah. And thanks to all of our listeners for tuning in again. It's so fun each week to learn and grow together and develop more tools of resilience. And thanks for sticking with us all these episodes along. We hope you'll go find us on your favorite podcast platform. Give us a like, a rating, and a review. It actually helps other people find the show. And as always, if you're listening to somebody else's story, odds are you have a story you could share that would help someone else. So feel free to reach out to us through social media at Relentlessly Resilient Podcast, or send us an email at rrpodcast@ksl.com.
And remember, whatever you do today, remember to be kind. You have no idea the struggles others are dealing with in their lives. Have a good day.
A gun in the face.
Then all of a sudden they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
Started 2 years of horror for an American in Venezuela.
They said, you need to give us your phone and get ready because you're coming with us.
I'm Becky Bruce, and I spent a year researching and piecing together Josh and Tammy Holt's story about their ordeal in a notorious prison.
That's when everything started to turn bad. We had another pound on the door. Boom, boom, boom. And there was the police once again.
You can binge all of the episodes of Hope and Darkness on kslpodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.